grab a slam from the board low later. And welcome to Shift F1, a podcast about speedy race cars. That is Australian, everybody, for let us obtain a quantity of beer, usually a box, from a liquor store. In honor, not only this week of Australia, not only because Australian supercars are racing in Albert Park this weekend, and there was a team once called Bottle-O, but also because, as helpfully pointed out to us by many listeners, Daniel Ricciardo has a new wine, everyone.
Danny,
what are your thoughts?
Yeah, shout out to all Daniel, vineyard-owning Daniels all over the place. I am not one of those. A new wine. We have yet to drink last year's wine, which was very kindly sent to us, Drew. We have now got a backlog of wine.
I know. He's just cranking out the vintages. Speaking of a fine vintage, also joining us, Rob Zachney. How are you, Rob?
Man, I need to figure out a way to get out there so we can all sip our wine, our Daniel Ricciardo wine, together on a veranda somewhere, preferably.
Hey, there might be a good reason to come in this direction next year.
That's true. Also, we should it should not go without saying that he also has a decanter to go along with the wine.
It doubles as a glass slipper.
It does, you're right.
You could do a modern Cinderella where after winning the prince's heart and becoming queen of the realm, she does a shoey for her mates, the mice.
Yeah, you have to see this, so I'm going to put a link to the show notes, Daniel Ricciardo's shoey decanter.
Yeah, it's something else.
It really is. If you are new to this podcast, a very warm welcome to you. Don't Drink in Podcast. If you're new to Formula One itself, we recommend listening to our pre-season primer episode. It assumes no prior F1 knowledge, so if you're new to this whole F1 thing, that explains how the sport works and who everybody is. So if you'd like to go back and listen to that, is episode 178. Also, the show is supported entirely by our audience over at patreon.com/shiftf1, where every month we release bonus podcasts and videos exclusively, easy for me to say, for our patrons. They cover racing documentaries and films, F1 video games, experiments with other racing series, and a lot of weird things. So if you would like to support the show and get access to all that fun stuff, head over to patreon.com/shiftf1 or click the link in the show notes. What do we have going on this month, Danny?
We have reviewed half of Drive to Survive Season 4. You can go check that out right now, and we will be doing the second half, the last five episodes, in any day now, like probably in the next couple of weeks. So that'll be up pretty soon, too. A massive shout out to all of our beautiful title sponsors. Tanner McLeave joining the team. I was thinking we might have to put a limit on the amenities because we're getting up to the... This has taken 5 minutes for me to say. Even longer now, because now I'm explaining it. Tanner McLeave, Bulgarian Bonbon, Mickey's 0.0, at NF... and I can never say it, never rolls off the tongue. I want to get through it as quick as possible. At NF1T underscore NFTs. Rough week for F1 NFTs with the closing of Delta Time. Although maybe this works out really well for them. I'm not really sure. They're complicated to me. Olivia Evans, Team Blackjack, Christian Horner, Pyrites Card Castle, Erica Siegel, Iron Station Studios, Alan McCrary, TelemetryDeck.com, Gnarly Goat, David Mule, Drew Stewart, Big Promble Motorsports, Bailey Foote, Abdallah Althani, Jason Chadwick, Abraham Getchell, Bunny Thork, Octocrimes. We've lost our hashtag.
Trying to trip you up now.
Yeah, no, Bunny Thorpe Octocrimes. I'm like sick, man. Don't give me these difficult word combinations. Sniggs, Alex Guichet, Reagan, Max Valtar, Circuit Demon. Thank you for the wine. We will eventually drink it. Troy Stammer, Umberto Roca, William Romph, and Jason Kelly.
Very good. Thank you, title sponsors. Should we jump right into it, everyone, and kick it off with the news here?
Let's do it. Do you want me to take this one?
Let's do it, Danny. Yeah.
Oh, man, we're going to Vegas. So they have announced another track for the 2023 season, and it is in Las Vegas, which I know, we're kind of like, all right, we're just sticking them in American cities now. We got Miami this year. We're going to Vegas. They have their East Coast. They have their Central. They have their West Coast. Denver is putting their hands up for mountain time so we can cover everyone off. But... it is perhaps the Vegas race that of our dreams. It's certainly one that's more compelling than what I thought it would be, which is we're going to do this in the parking lot of a casino again. They're doing it on the Strip.
Yeah.
Which is pretty crazy. Like, there are street circuits. We're used to street circuits. Monaco, obviously. You drive around 90% of all Monaco streets in Monaco. Singapore, you know, it's in a commercial district of the town. It's you know, it's not an unbusy part of the town. But doing it down the main promenade of the Vegas Strip is something that I didn't really consider. And as sort of cynical as you can be about this, and there have been people saying, like, oh, I'm not so sure about this one. There's no denying that, like, doing it down the Strip, and again, at nighttime, because the race is going to start at 10 p.m.
on a Saturday.
On a Saturday. It's a really, like, it is very sort of F1 money cynical, which is something we talk about a lot, especially if we just left Jeddah. But it kind of rocks. Like, I'm kind of into this. Maybe there's bias here because it's also like an hour flight from where we are, and that's the closest F1 has been in donkey's years. Austin is about a 4-hour flight. But yeah, they're going to resurface the Strip for this. The track layout looks kind of good.
It looks roomy, which like street circuits so rarely do, right? Like I think we are so used to so the worst street circuit that has been introduced in years, not in F1. If anyone saw, I think it was like the Nashville race that IndyCar ran last year, dog shit. You know why? Because they were so hell-bent on having the cars run over the bridge in Nashville that they just basically used the highway interchange as like one end of the course. And like that's how you can have it go wrong when you're going for that photo op, right? Where that's the only thing you're prioritizing. I think the nice thing about Vegas is like you're gonna have the long like shots of the Strip as the car's whipping down that back straight, but it's still gonna be in the background as they loop back around behind the Strip. And like it's still like there is going to be like fast sectors and slow corners. You know, places where people can get a decent view of the race. It has the look of what I associate with like good street circuits, right? Which is like some long runs, some sharp but hopefully wide corners. It could be awesome. Also, it sure would be nice to have an F1 race at a venue where like you can just get off the plane 5 minutes later, you're at the track.
That's
a different world than other like races like force you to live in, right? Like
how about this? You mightn't even need a ticket to the race if you get a hotel room that's high enough. Because like
it's true
on the Strip, it's like all hotels, a lot of them facing the Strip. I mean, some of them will have a fairly limited view of this, and I'm sure the ticket prices are going to be, you know, vague, you know, ratcheted up a lot for this. But that's quite interesting. Imagine waking up and seeing F2 just like, you know, doing their practice in the morning. You'll probably be woken up actually rather by some of these.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine being here not for the F1 race.
Right.
You know?
So we don't know when it is exactly. They said November of next year. A lot of people have been saying, does that mean the Thanksgiving weekend? Does it not mean the Thanksgiving weekend?
God, 10 p.m. on Thanksgiving weekend. Jesus.
Maybe that's why they don't do it on a Sunday. There's like a load of like scuttlebutt about that. I want to go.
Yeah,
like I want to go to this. Austin is fun. Arguably, you could drive to this one from here. It's not. Yeah. It's not okay. That bad.
So wait. So the plan is get F1 tickets, watch the race, stay up all night, go to the Raiders game.
No, I am not going to a Las Vegas Raiders game. I'm still upset about that. I live in Oakland.
Stadium looks good, man. Seems like a real fun place to see a game.
Golden State Warriors skipped across the bridge. Raiders once again left. We'll see them back in 10 years as long as the A's stay. If the A's stay, I'm out of Oakland. That's it.
You mean if they go? Yeah.
Oh, my God. But yeah, this seems like a fun, like presumably they're going to start the race weekend then on the Thursday, I'm guessing, to get this all up to speed. It's very weird doing it on a Saturday. I get it for television stuff. That means it'll land fairly early, actually, UK time. The rest of Europe.
I think it's 5 a.m., which I saw a bunch of people in the UK going like, oh, 5 a.m. for a Formula One race.
Oh, you summer children. Welcome to our world.
So they
don't have an equivalent, right?
The other thing that occurred to me, though, is like, it's so wild that, okay, they're doing this like race at 10 p.m. local, right? You are basically mandating that for all of American F1, this is a party weekend. Or you're just going to be like, you know, kind of like sad, and you're going to go to bed and like, I'll catch the race in the morning because I can't stay. Like, for me on the East Coast, right, this race can be rolling off at midnight, right? Like,
Oh, 1 a.m.
1 a.m. Nope. Because, yeah, Vegas is West Coast time. So, like, I have the choice between I'll catch it in the morning or I just commit to, like, it's a party weekend. F1 has declared it to be so. So it is time to stay up until the wee hours watching a live F1 race.
And really, this is the only place in America you could do a 10 p.m. race.
That's true. That is very true. There's probably quite a lot of laws about noise in most places. Could you imagine the poor people? There's going to be some like poor people who have been dying to go to Vegas their whole lives, or they're just regulars who hang out, you know, all the time and stay in their really expensive suite at the Wynn right on turn four or whatever it is. And like at 10 o'clock, you know, Aunt Maisie's going to sleep, and then suddenly, she's like, what the fuck? It's like 2 hours of that. That's, oh man. Yeah, we should go. I'm
in.
We should go. The big asterisk that's in the corner for this is just how much expensive is this race weekend going to be? Because you can have a cheap, you can have a like a good time in Vegas on a budget. It's not,
yeah,
it's, there's a lot of options in Vegas. It's not that, you know, it's not Monaco. There is,
right?
It, you know, it's kind of pretending to be more lash than it is, and you can waste a lot of money in the casinos, of course, but it is it's an accessible place to go to, especially if you live, you know, relatively close to it. So I do wonder, yeah, like how gougy hotel prices will be.
They're also saying, so Austin pulled in 400,000 people for that race weekend.
Yes, biggest race last year in terms of attendance.
How does that one of the scale biggest ever? Like the largest conferences that Vegas hosts, right? That'd be the other question, is like, is this like, can the Strip absorb that number of bookings for this kind of thing? Because I think that's gonna be part of it too, is like, I'm sure there's gonna be people like staying, there's all the sort of outlying casinos, there's Old Vegas, etc., where I'm sure people will be staying, but like, I think we're all agreed here, if we're doing this, we would sure want to be down where these sort of red circuit traces are placed around the Strip, rather than like coming in from, I don't know, like the Nugget.
Yeah, I have to assume with all the hotels that it's fairly, because like Austin, I get it, because Austin is a conference town too, right, with South by Southwest, and a large amount of that is soaked up by private sort of rental Airbnb type stuff in Austin, because it doesn't have that many hotels, but they're able to sort of like hold that many folks. And then also Austin, I feel like there is a lot of people coming in from the surrounding area who live around there as well.
Yeah.
I'm not quite sure if the local Vegas crowd will be so into F1 necessarily. To me, I don't know, but maybe I'm wrong, but Texas strikes me as a little bit more motorsport adjacent for that type of stuff. So yeah, it's a good question. I assume
Vegas loves spectacle.
Yeah, that's true. Like I assume they'll be able to soak it up. And whether or not we'll get that many numbers though.
You know,
CES, yeah, the VG, what's the porn awards, what are they called?
I don't know. Yeah.
They used to be on around the same time as CES, I think.
I've heard that,
that's true, famously.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Andy Bauman's got some great stories about that.
Pointing out that this is the first time, as you said, Danny, there used to be a race in Vegas in the parking lot of a hotel. It was really weird. Like, it was just kind of a back and forth. Looked kind of like an autocross track.
The go-kart.
Yeah, or a go-kart track. That was at Caesar's Palace Grand Prix. Last in 1982, which is also the last time there were three races in the United States. So there is precedent for this. It was Las Vegas, Detroit, and Long Beach.
Yeah, right. Long Beach. Yeah, that's one of the only ones that they might be able to do still again, because there's so many tracks that either won't work on modern F1 because of rule. Like, I was looking this up because there was, you know, the argument is, oh, why is there three races in America? Well, obviously, you know, the F1 was bought by an American company. It is probably the biggest expansion market available to them, at least in you know, closest to them, easiest to them to expand into. And there's a lot of tracks that just wouldn't work. Like Laguna Seca wouldn't work. It doesn't pass regulations. Outside of the corkscrew, it doesn't have the runoff required. It's also like really short. I think the lap times there would be under a minute. So that's not possible. Places like Sonoma Motor Speedway don't have the required pits for F1. They don't have enough sort of like that type of like buildings and infrastructure, I guess. I went through a bunch. I think Watkins Glen might be one of the... But then that's another East Coast, you know, when you've already got Miami going on, so I don't know.
And you
got
to think about all those people, right? Like, getting to the track, it's going to be a nightmare if it doesn't have the infrastructure around there.
Yeah, in a weird way, Vegas is, like, oddly... Like, you both... Rob said it earlier as well. Like, it is oddly well set up for not racing necessarily, but like this type of thing, getting a bunch of people into town and then getting them out and having it so that like you can access stuff and the traffic isn't crazy and there's places to stay. Like, yeah, like if we did this in Laguna Seca, like where does everyone stay? It's in the middle of, no, it's like outside Monterey. It's like not even close to a city, really.
Yeah.
So you're right.
There's only the three grade one circuits in the US, and one of them is the Indy infield track, which we're never going back there in F1.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm curious if any of the grade twos could be converted, because there's some great ones there.
Yeah, is there any, do you have any list in front of you or any?
Well, I mean, you know, I mean, obviously, like, the Glen is there, but that might be harder to convert because, like, there is topography there that they're kind of up against. It's a bit like Spa, right? In terms of there being hills. Yeah, Laguna Seca.
By the way, have you guys seen Eau Rouge? Or Radeon, rather?
Some of the reprofiling?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
It's interesting, isn't it?
It looks good.
It looks way less drastic a change than I thought it would be.
No, it looks like a really smart reprofiling. Demolishing that lodge, I think, really cleared up a whole bunch of space.
Yeah, they basically didn't have to do anything on the right, which I guess they couldn't because of the cliff.
Okay, there's probably no way they could do this. If they could convert Virginia International Raceway to an F1 track, that'd be pretty nuts.
Arlington or Richmond, or where is it?
Yeah, it's in a place called Alton, I guess, which I have no idea where that is. Oh, that's Southern Virginia. That's all the way down there. That's basically Carolina.
It's very, yeah, okay. So south of Richmond, then, is it?
Yeah.
Alton, Virginia.
Elizabeth Blackstock on Jalopnik has an article called "Trust Me, You Don't Want Formula One to Return to Your Favorite Classic Venues."
Right. Yeah.
And her point is basically like if you want the track to conform to F1 standards, it's going to lose a lot of its character.
That's probably true. You know,
tight runoff, and I mean that's why Monaco is so amazing, is because there's no way, as they say, there's no way that. Would be greenlit these days.
Oh my God, I forgot about the best part of this. You just reminded me. I forgot about the best part of this. This knocks Circuit Paul Ricard off the calendar next year. I am 2 out of 3, folks. My 3 least favorite tracks. We got rid of Sochi. We got rid of Paul Ricard. Jeddah, I'm coming for you. Although I don't necessarily hate that track. It does provide good races. I just don't like... I don't like how dangerous it is. And also... There are the overriding political concerns around it. Yeah,
no, but
I'm so happy, man.
It's a good point. I think, boy, the pressure's on Miami though, right? Because like you're kind of wedged between like this is now the destination race. Oh, like let's see, what am I going to choose between? I go to the Hard 100%. Rock Stadium or the Vegas Strip to see a race.
Yeah,
like totally. not a contest.
Vegas is now very much based on people on the East Coast who. For some reason, like, although to be honest, if like when I lived in like Maryland, like flying to Florida and flying to Texas, they're both, you know, I know Florida's closer, but like I might as well go to Texas if that was the case.
Don't feel closer.
But I think Miami now is very much a local crowd, and they do have a lot of racing fans in there, so
yeah,
that's a big part of it. But that feels more like that now, doesn't it? Like less of a destination.
Yeah, I think that race might be up against it, because I think Coda's a good venue.
It's a much easier calculation to say like, we can turn Las Vegas into a whole weekend, right? Of not just F1 stuff. Like there's so much to do in Vegas. If you're a Vegas kind of person, I guess, there are a lot of people complaining, I guess, People not non-Americans saying like, why three races in America? I think we kind of covered that. It's a humongous market, but Sean Kelly on who's at Virtual Statman on Twitter, he's a is or was a Formula One statistician, also just a great Twitter follow, was pointing out that even if you assume 750 million people within Europe, that means that'd be twice as many people as in the USA. Europe has 11 races this season, so if they have just over twice as many races as the USA, that then gives the USA 4 to 5 races per season.
Yeah,
not the 3 we currently have.
Yeah, it's very much like
keeping in perspective.
Yeah, like the bias towards what is normal, I guess. Like, you know, I'm sure similar things were being said about the, you know, Arabian Peninsula over the past few years in terms of an expansion market. Like, we got all the races down there. You know, there was no races until Dubai. Yeah,
and that's Italy, much easier Italy to be has two about.
Hebe, what's the population of Italy? 60 million? They have 2 races. They, right. They renamed one San Marino, even though it's not in San Marino. So, like, it's
right. He also, I think, I don't know if it was him or somebody else, but he posted like the Google Maps directions from Spa to, you know, the Nürburgring. And then he posted, you know, the Google Maps from Miami to Texas.
Dude, do Monaco to Paul Ricard.
Right.
It's like 40 minutes away. Like, it's the same part of France. Yeah, sure. Monaco's a city state. It's they're both in France. There's 2 French Grand Prix and none of them are very good. Bring back Manny Cor, for God's sake. That's the other thing. I have already seen people saying like, oh, this will be sad because we'll lose a French Grand Prix. Like, Paul Ricard was always such a bandage for having a French Grand Prix. It never felt, I don't know, I don't like Le Castellet. I don't like that track. Although I will say the sort of like cosmic irony of this will probably be that the new red cars will race really well on Paul Ricard, and then suddenly I'll be like annoyed that we're leaving.
We had a good race last year. Yeah, I mean, who knows? But yeah, I mean, I think that's like, it's a fair point, but I think it's one of those things where I think a lot of this comes down to it is the fact that F1 has like for decades kind of put all its classic venues through the ringer, the places that people really love, the places where there's a lot of like homegrown support. And like this goes back to the Ecclestone era, right? Where it was like there was never an expansion race being funded by some sort of petrostate anywhere on the planet that F1 wouldn't say yes to and throw a, you know, classic European venue under the bus for. That is continuing, but at least the difference here is you can say there is like an actual large racing market in the US. You know, I think maybe the 3 venues they've chosen, I think I have some clear doubts about Miami, but I think the, you know, real issue is, yeah, there's 3 races on the Arabian Peninsula and like only one of them seems to be reliably great. And they come with a whole host of, sorry, 4 races on the Arabian Peninsula. I forget that Abu Dhabi, we loop back around there right, to fuck up the season every year. So like that's kind of the thing is, you know, the real frustration is that F1 is chasing growth on the one hand and easy payouts on the other. And what gets squeezed there in the middle is reliable markets and beloved venues. But, you know, that's what F1 has been for 20 years.
Yeah, and like I would rather them at least go to places where there's going to be people, because the problem you get is like China is a big problem because that track was, yes, it's in China, but it's like miles from a major city and they've never filled any of those, you know, stands out on the outside of the track. At least when they've tried, I think, to go to interesting places too. Like Baku is a really interesting one.
Yeah.
Like not what you'd necessarily assume is a place that F1 would expand into. And also a street circuit, which you think, oh, well, they're not building something. It's a little bit like we're throwing this together. Baku's been great.
Yeah.
So I do think there's more thought going into some of these. Although I will say it really, there is such an obvious difference between when we look at Vegas and Miami that's the one thing that causes me to, you know, put some doubt in that, because Miami does look like the Caesar's Palace, right?
Yes. They can say however many times they want. It's not going to be like we're racing in the parking lot as they lay out a trace outline in the parking lot. But yeah, it's going to be a problem. Anyway, we should probably hit some other news.
Yeah. And I would also throw Baku in sort of the petro state.
Yeah, that's fair.
With terrible human rights. But yeah,
that's fair.
Yeah. But yeah, let's move on to Sebastian Vettel getting back in the car for Australia. He had COVID for the first two races. Nico Hülkenberg filled in for him. But Vettel will be back in a sort of strange piece of symmetry because we haven't been to Australia in 2 years' time, three calendar years, because they called off the Australian Grand Prix in March 2020.
Yeah.
Like as close as you could pot the hours before practice. I think people had already shown up to the track and they were like, we're not doing this.
They were really wishing COVID away that weekend. I think the rest of the world at that stage was shaking their heads and going, no, this, I remember Hamilton at the time was very vocally saying like, I can't believe this race is going ahead. McLaren pulled out, I believe, first.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. And then one of their team members had COVID.
Oh, you're right. That's what it was. Yeah.
But it was like, even like a week before, I think in our episode before that, or in our pre-race episode, it was like a guy in Australia or in Melbourne had COVID and went to a restaurant, right? Yeah. And we were like, we're going to have to watch this. And then it exploded from there.
We were asking, right? We're getting emails from folks in Australia about it, about how, you know, what's it like around the track? And they're like, oh, all the restaurants are open and, you know, nothing's changed and looks like it's okay. And then the numbers start going up. And to remind people, this was sort of historically in recent memory, the first race of the season as well. So this was the opening of the 2020 season.
That's right.
So, delighted to go back here. Also, the interesting thing about it, we'll get into it in the track stuff later, is that the silver lining, if there can be a silver lining to a global pandemic which has taken the lives of millions, is that at the least they have used the 2 years off to reprofile the track some very interesting ways, which we'll talk about later.
Right. Well, speaking of teams and changes and all of that, Rob, you've got a number of things here in the Rob section.
Yeah, so there's growing focus. This is already such a going to be a weird season. The budget cap is going to be more restrictive. But, you know, crucially, it's already clear now that there are a few teams that, like, there's two teams that clearly have, like, winning race cars right now, Red Bull and Ferrari. There's a lot of teams not that far off from being, like, front runners. And that is usually your cue for, man, it's going to be a midseason development war. It is going to be, and this has been the arc of the last couple championships, particularly last year. That thing swung like a pendulum based on like the upgrades and improvements teams were able to roll out. One of the markers that Mattia Binotto already sort of put down was basically saying that F1 really needs to police the budget cap aggressively, because there's going to be such incentive to push it in the middle of a development war. And so, like, Binotto's out there, they're saying, like, because like there are so many different ways to account for money, has anyone's done like any sort of business accounting or like household finances, right? Like how you move money around, how you like account for what goes into what bucket is actually really complicated, even when you're like everything is on the level. When there's like massive incentive to be like, well, can we move this into some exempt categories, it's gonna get trickier. And so Binotto is sort of calling for F1 to be really proactive about this, because if teams get the sense that, you know, that the cops aren't watching, right, there is going to be sort of a collective pressure across the grid to like push the limits. Here's the other thing though, those limits, like the cost cap was already something that teams were not like, they'd all sort of recognized that it was necessary and were able to accept it. But something that has emerged about this season in particular that didn't seem like it was going to be such a big deal. Freight costs, the logistical price tag associated with moving your team around the world to all these races, is not exempt from the budget cap. That is part of your operating budget. And a number of teams have sort of pointed out that it's already kind of exploded in terms of how much it is costing them just to getting their team, getting their equipment and cars around two different tracks. And so that's one of the other issues, is that they're supposed to have like 142.4 million each year to spend on this. But a much larger chunk of that than anyone anticipated is being committed to logistics. So the normal arc that we see with these things, and to give you an example of like how expensive, Christian Horner actually said it's probably going to be double what the freight costs have been in previous years.
Wow.
Both to the combination of like the shipping industry charging higher fees, and then the fact that like all commodities across the board, but particularly like oil, are more expensive.
Of course.
These things are going to sort of have a knock-on pressure. That also, though, changes the calculation a little bit, even if you set aside the budget cap a little bit, in terms of like how tightly it's being policed. There comes the question, and Autosport wrote a really good piece about this called, let's see, the hare and tortoise dilemma at the heart of F1's 2022 team battle. And the argument that Autosport is making is that, you know, in the past, teams would just like roll out a bunch of upgrades, see how they do, roll out more upgrades as the season rolls along. But here, as we've seen in previous years, the season like has so many different phases that there's a lot of incentive. Like, you can get a lot of value out of a judiciously deployed like mid to late season upgrade that you roll out. And so to what degree are teams going to be rushing upgrades out the door just to get their 2022 cards into what they think is going to be their peak trim for the season versus to what degree are teams going to hold their fire and wait and see how things play out with like smaller upgrades and then see where the field is at later in the season. Both strategies have their gamble, because if you blow your budget on like upgrades to the cars as they exist right now, you might be overtaken technically mid to late season. At that point, you can't really respond. But the other thing this piece pointed out is nobody's ever tested in court. Like, what happens if you blow your budget?
Right.
Like, F1 doesn't operate like a lot of leagues. Like, to a degree, this would become a civil action. It's not like, because it immediately come down to, well, how do you account? Like, what's your accounting standard by which we blew our budget? Because we don't think we did. Would F1, like, imagine the controversy of the season finale last year. Except instead of being something everyone could see on track and hear the radio messages, the fight between the teams comes down to like accounting firms like presenting like spreadsheets in court to determine a championship. Like,
that's the real F1.
Is F1 really going to let it get there? Like, that's the thing. But if the willingness to police the cost cap is a bluff, then it will be blown out of the water. Maybe not like massively, but like that $142 million figure will not hold up, and it'll be like $142 million and like whatever we could fudge. So that's already becoming one of the major like not friction points, but one of the major concerns in the early stages of like the strategy the teams are running this early in the season. I also got a kick out of the fact that Gunther was in there being like, upgrades are overrated. which, you know, it's interesting. His argument is like in 2019, as we famously recall, they basically went down a developmental cul-de-sac and like built a worse like you know, 2.0 version of their car, that it was Grosjean, right, who was like, it's worse, I'm telling you, it's worse. And then when they ran when they ran them side by side, it turned out that their new car didn't work. And the Steiner's point is that it's very easy to rush upgrades out the door, but you probably are better off trying to figure out what are the fundamental issues with your car concept rather than like strapping a bunch of different like aerodynamic components to it in the hope of turning it around. I don't know that that is, I think that is a singular experience, and it does make me kind of think about like formative experiences when you consider like F1 teams. Haas is so marked by the fact that like the worst thing possible happened to them, right? Which is right as they kind of ran out of development money and went into a sort of a stand pat moment, they built a bad car. One that they could never really sort out. And it is interesting to see in this new environment, these are the lessons Steiner's bringing into this with him. Are they good lessons, or are they just good lessons for Steiner? Because that, I kind of wonder about that, right? Like, oh man, this dude is just scarred by the fact that he spent like 2 years wrestling with a car he didn't know how to fix. Is that a good principle by which to guide the technical development of a car? I don't know.
Yeah. Speaking of car development and guessing a lot.
Yeah, who would have thought? Mercedes? Talking about Haas, to be able to say something similar about Mercedes now is very interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Basically, that Andrew Shovlin from Mercedes was kind of, he's their like head of trackside engineering. He's somebody we end up quoting a lot every year, but like he was sort of saying that Mercedes don't know what the pace of their car is. Like, we've seen it. Doesn't look good. But the issue is that car is hobbled by the fact that they are already running it well outside, like, what would be ideal parameters to deal with the porpoising. The porpoising is so bad that when you run it to, like, max spec or most efficient setup, the car is just hell to drive and basically undrivable. But they don't know what's causing it. They don't know fully how to fix it. They've experimented with some of the obvious stuff. They sort of cut away pieces of the floor, thinking that maybe it would reduce some of the porpoising that's coming via ground effect. That didn't solve it. But until they know what it is, like, they're still thinking that if not for the porpoising, they may have a really competitive car that they just can't like set up to take full advantage. So like step one for them is to figure out why is this like violent shuddering on the straights happening to us? Because until they answer that and tame it, they can't really know whether their car concept for this year, which already looks kind of different from what a lot of other teams are doing, whether that car concept is fatally flawed. Now, for me, the big if there is, what if the fatal flaw is that it porpoises so damned much? Right? Like, what if the problem is that, like, if you solve for the porpoising issue, like, the car concept is just, like, kind of a dead letter? I don't know, but it certainly leaves Mercedes in, like, by far the worst position I think I've seen them since probably the launch of the team.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, but this is one of the things that's really interesting to follow over the course of a season, right? Who can out-develop the other teams, who can fix their problems, who, you know, just plummets through the rankings. So yeah, we're going to watch all of this throughout the season, just like we're going to watch the Australian Grand Prix this weekend. By the way, thanks to Matt Hagler on Twitter for pointing this out. This is the first instance I know of these new... C1 through C5 tire era that we're in, that we have skipped a compound. So if you recall, there are five compounds of decreasing hardness from the hard C1 to the very soft C5. And Pirelli, the tire manufacturer, selects three of those for a given weekend. And then those become the hard, medium, and soft. This weekend, the hard is the C2, the medium is the C3, and the soft is the C5. So we've skipped the C4.
Whoa.
Yeah.
C4 is too explosive for this track.
Or not soft enough. It's interesting. You would think that there'd be like a linear graph here on the softness, and you would want, I don't know, maybe it's that the C3 is not hard enough.
Maybe it's just about competitive, right? Like they were just like looking at it. It's like, this is not an interesting like performance span between if it's linear. And so they have to have a part of the tire spectrum that goes like kerchunk, and like you're going to have to deal with it because otherwise it's just going to be too samey in terms of setups. This is always the weird thing about these tire things. It really is like, it is kind of how you are arranging the terms of the contest, right? It is a bit like you're trying to engineer for like what kind of race do we want to have. I'm excited they did it. I've always sort of wondered, like, that'd be a fun little monkey wrench to toss into the tire strategy. Is like, hey, one of these things is really not like the other.
Yeah, yeah. Melbourne is also like a fairly bumpy track, but they have resurfaced it this year. So with the new cars as well, who knows, there might be a little bit of a spanner in the works. But yeah, I like the idea with them playing with it, especially as tire strategy is like clearly really important this year with like, you know, it seems like a lot more stops as well. On average, we're getting more stops in these, you know, it's only been two races, but they've proved very, very tactical that way.
It's true. Well, let's get to the Australian Grand Prix in Melbourne, Danny.
Yes, excited to be back. Although it is new, it has gotten a pretty substantial facelift, let's say. We've been here since about 1996. It's a 58 lap race, 5.3 kilometers. Shumi has the lap record in 2004, but we're gonna get average speed increase of about 70 kilometers an hour this year. So who knows? It might be finally broken. It has undergone changes in the past. This is a sort of temporary circuit in that it takes place in a park in the center of Melbourne. There are some parts of it which are roads during the year that I don't think they're public roads. I think they're maybe just for park people. I'm not quite sure exactly. And then there is the start finish sort of like circuit area of it, which is built for the F1. So it's a bit of a mixture that way. But like I said, they're resurfacing it this year. So it'll all have a nice new lick of tarmac. The changes, though, some are subtle, some are substantial. So one of the problems with this track, and it's a fantastic track and people really like it and the flow of it's really good, but one of the issues was it was always very narrow. And also a lot of the turns were turns that you couldn't overtake on. They were sort of sharp and narrow in themselves. So you couldn't really, you know, throw up the inside because both cars were like going to such a low speed anyway, and you mightn't be able to like cut the apex. So there was very particular places in which you would overtake on this track. There was a lot of like down into turn one, down into turn three. And then if you didn't get it there, maybe it hazarded into turn 11 and then that was it. These were like the three right-hand turns, you know, 90 degree turns that you would try to throw it down the inside of. So loads has been changed. So turn one, turn three, as I mentioned, and turn 11, and also turn 13, which is the penultimate weird little left-hander, they've all been opened up quite a lot. So the apex of the corner has been opened up, which should hopefully allow cars to drive through them rather than brake and turn into them. But the more substantial changes that have happened are at turn six, which is, if you remember, you kind of go under the trees a little bit at the end of sector one, and then you have a sort of a little right-hander. That's been opened up quite a lot. It was a pretty conservative corner because it was like gravel on the outside of it, so you really didn't want to get beached out there. So that's been opened up so that basically the pace that cars have coming out of that first sector can continue. So hopefully they'll continue to be a little bit closer, you know, exiting turn six. And this is where things really change. So there used to be basically a sort of not a chicane, but a really tight right-hander, which slowed everyone down on what was the old turn nine. So that's effectively been removed. So instead of when we're out of that turn six, we're basically into like a sort of I daren't call it a straight. They haven't given it a number, the turn, but it's basically a flat out part of the track. the detection point for DRS has been brought earlier, and there's going to be two DRS zones there. They've already done this on the front of the track. There's a DRS detection point at the start of the start-finish straight, and it works for 2 points. It works for the start-finish and then between turn two and turn three. So they're doing the same here on the other side.
They done that before? The four DRS zones, but two detection points. It's almost like there's two DRS zones with a break in between each one.
Yeah, I don't. They had the first one on this one, but they used to only have the what is now the fourth DRS zone was the third one, and the DRS detection point.
Have you seen four on a track before?
Have I seen four on a track? I'm trying to think. The Spa, what, one of the big ones? No, that's got one, two. It's only got two. I think. No, three. Is there one on the start finish? No, because that start finish straight's not long enough. Yeah, so I think maybe that they only have two there. So four is a lot. But yeah, like you said, they're kind of, you know, daisy chained a little bit, because now hopefully turn one and two will be a little bit faster, because it's an awkward turn. It's kind of like a, you know, turn one is quite sharp, so you can get around turn two. And it's kind of like a faster start of Monza. And then turn nine and 10 have actually always been taking at speed. There's not much overtaking room there between 9 and 10, but you should be able to hopefully follow a little bit more this year than you could in the past too. So it's exciting. It really opens up this track quite a lot. It means that instead of there being very like particular places to overtake and the rest of it, you have to be sort of fairly steady. In this one, it's almost like there's lots of overtaking spots, and then you've got breathers in between them. The breather being like the end of sector three. And I think that's it.
Like
maybe coming out of turn three, because that's a pretty slow corner, but we'll have to see. We'll have to see how fast they're able to take these turns in practice. So it's interesting. It's a very, you know, fundamental change to this whole thing. And then a lot of other turns, like turn 11 has been widened, like I said, but that final sector, the sort of little arena section there, which was usually quite slow, has been opened up as well. So yeah, I think this track has always been beloved and has given us a lot of interesting races, and it's always the first, well, historically it was the first race of the season, which I think also played into a lot of people enjoying it. But we could have a really interesting race here. We could have a lot of places to throw the car up the inside, and hopefully the rest of the track feels wider, because it was always quite constrained here.
Yeah, I mean, differences in the track, differences in the cars. I have no idea what to expect going into here. Except some balmy weather. We've got, looks to be about 75 degrees Fahrenheit or 24 Celsius on qualifying day, with no precipitation and light wind. And Sunday, just a few degrees warmer, same light wind, but at race time and steadily climbing, we look to have a precipitation chance of 16%.
Whoa, 16, baby.
Yes.
16. Put it
and
all
climbing.
On red.
Yes, and that's the weather. Let's get to the driver standings here. Charles Leclerc leads the Drivers' Championship with 45 points ahead of his teammate Carlos Sainz with 33. Max Verstappen, with his win last time out, has 25 points. And George Russell is in fourth with 22. Lewis Hamilton right behind with 16 points in fifth place. Esteban Ocon's in sixth with 14 points. Sergio Perez and Kevin Magnussen are tied with 12 in seventh place. Valtteri Bottas is in ninth with eight. Lando Norris is in 10th with 6, and we've got a tie between Yuki Tsunoda and his teammate Pierre Gasly for 11th place with 4 points. Fernando Alonso has 2. Zhou Guan Yu has 1 point in 14th place, and we've got Mick Schumacher, Lance Stroll, Nico Hülkenberg, Alexander Albon, Daniel Ricciardo, and Nicholas Latifi, and Sebastian Vettel with 0.
Ricciardo's going to want to get off the bottom of his whole race.
Oh, in the worst way, I'm sure. In the constructor standings, Ferrari is on top with 78 points. Mercedes is in second with 38 points, 1 point ahead of Red Bull in third. Wow. Alpine is in fourth with 16. Gene Haas and team have 12 points. Alfa Romeo is in sixth with 9. Alfa Tauri has 8. McLaren is in eighth place with 6 points. Then we've got Aston Martin and Williams with 0. If you'd like to join the standings yourself, you can join our fantasy league using the link in the show notes. pick your turbo driver heading into Australia. And that's the standings. Let's take it to emails, Danny.
Yeah, shiftf1podcast@gmail.com or f1.cool/emails. This first one, Drew, do you mind taking it? Ryan C. has a problem with the helmet cam.
It seems so. Ryan says, the helmet cam must be stopped. It sucks. You can't see anything when they swap to it, and they are doing so at key moments. Leclerc is trying to pass Verstappen, but you, the viewer, are in the dark because you're subjected to this visual cacophony when they have dozens of other angles to choose from. I understand.
I might agree.
Nope.
But this is, I think this is a problem with
direction.
Direction, live switching. This is not a problem with the helmet cam. The helmet cam is dope.
Yep.
I love the helmet cam. Not only does it is it a different looking image. I think Danny, you said it was. Did you say this was like a J.J. Abrams lens flare with all the lights coming in?
I didn't, but that's a very good way of putting it. And maybe it'll look better in the daytime.
Yeah.
If he doesn't like that. Even.
I love the helmet cam. I do think, like, yes, it's not a good camera angle for, like, if you're trying to capture, like, a crucial racing moment because the entire thing, the cool thing about it is, like, it is as close as we're going to get to driver's eye view. And also, it really does bring home the sense of like speed and violence of driving these cars in a way that like is really immediate. So I like the Paul Greengrassian quality of the helmet cam. Here's my pet peeve though. So if you notice the TV pod has an amazing view down into the cockpit where you can see what the drivers are doing on the wheels and stuff. Mm-hmm. But when they switch the in-car view, the fucking graphic comes up and it blocks the steering wheel and like what the driver is doing there. There is so much real estate on this like graphics package. Move the frigging. We already, by the way, we don't even need, we're in the guy's car. We know who we're looking at probably, but like move that graphic off so we can like stare at the steering wheel. Please. Yeah. I must know what are they doing.
Some of the direction in Abu Dhabi was a bit suspect too. In Jeddah, it was suspect too, where there was a lot of like, because there's more fighting in more of the track, they were sort of not showing, like they kept showing replays of what was going on at the end of battles between Charles Leclerc and Max Verstappen, while I'm like, I think they're probably pretty close to each other right now. Like, let me go back to the action, please. It's almost as if the directors aren't used to there being this much action that they're like throwing up these replays. So I found Saudi to be a little bit, usually F1, you know, direction is the type of thing you don't think of because it's fairly great a lot of the time. But maybe just me, but I found that a bit frustrating during the more action packed moments of Jeddah.
Yeah, I would say maybe as a rule to keep the helmet cam, limit the helmet cam to replays. But I love seeing it. I love seeing, you know, the driver move their head back and forth to look at their mirrors. There was a cool, I retweeted this from, and I can put it in the show notes. I retweeted it from the Shift F1 Twitter account. Someone had like taken a close look at the interface of the display of the steering wheel on Charles Leclerc's car and kind of broke it out into, you know, what each element meant. It's pretty cool. But yeah, that's my feelings on the helmet cam. Mm. Thank you, Ryan.
Rob, you want to take this one from Dave R?
Yeah. Dave writes, Charles should get credit for a move by having it named after him. Not the let you buy at this corner so I can have DRS through the next straight and get round before the next corner. The Charles is an overtake followed by a quick, short move across the middle of the track to shut the door and force the following car into a compromised angle into the corner. He's done it twice to Max to keep Max from pulling a Brazil and dive bombing the inside, even if it goes off the track. The first time was lap 17 in Bahrain. The second was lap 43 at turn 1 in Saudi Arabia. I think we'll be seeing the Charles from all the drivers this year because the cars are so much better at following and repassing. Yeah, I'll have to look at his decision making in those moments again. The racing was really good. Nothing jumped out at me as like a really distinctive defensive move. I'm really interested if he's like closing off a line that Max has been looking for. I think that definitely bears some watching because it does seem like we're going to be seeing them race a lot this year.
Yeah, I'm going to look out for that in Melbourne. The Charles, mm-hmm. Can you prove on the name, like the cheeky Charles or the That's all I got, actually.
I kind of like the Charles.
Yeah. The Charles. Mr. Charles. Was that an Inception? Was that what he called himself? Mr. Charles, when he did the whole... Sorry, we're going deep into the Inception lore here. I'll take this next question from Tom Orr in Houston. Went from Dave Orr to Tom Orr. They're just making me say Orr in my weird Irish accent. Between qualifying laps, when the cars are in the garage and the drivers are still in their seats, video monitors are attached to the halo support bar right in front of them. What are they watching? Replays? Lap stats? Twilight movies? We got a lot of emails about this. So I am assuming that this is a people new to the sport or people watching practice or quali for the first time type of thing.
They're watching streamers.
Yeah, they're watching the latest memes. It's important to be on top of your meme game in F1, as Lando has shown. So those screens that come down, they are there's a lot of stuff. So the main way to communicate with the driver at that stage is the engineers are radioed into them and can talk to them. But they are looking at sector times. They're looking at split times. They're looking at sometimes replays of other of the general feed. They're sometimes looking at replays of their own laps too. The general sort of use of those is to give them live knowledge of what's going on the track, how it's evolving, so that they can sort of analyze it and change the next time they run out. If it's during something like a practice session, sometimes there are more detailed stuff about, you know, rundowns of what they're supposed to do for that practice, for, you know, maybe they're doing a long fuel load or maybe they're doing a test on a certain tire or something like that. We also had some questions about the pens. So sometimes they have, the drivers have very limited movement in the cars, but sometimes they give them like Sharpies so that they can communicate with the walls. They're like digital pens that sort of like will draw so they can say, oh, here I was doing this, and it'll come up on a screen in a different part of the garage. So it's not like a Sharpie that they're drawing on the screen. As far as I know, at least, it is a digital stylus that is communicating back to somebody else.
It looked to me like they were also using the stylus to, because again, yeah, you're right, Danny, their arms are kind of cramped in the car. They can't just reach up and use the touchscreen. They might be like changing pages in there with that too.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Right, that makes sense. Yeah, like using it as like a little joystick almost.
Right.
Yeah. Rob,
is that new? I don't think I've seen the stylus before.
No, I think it's new. I think I saw Lando use it. Yeah, I assume it's somewhat new. But it's hard because they don't often show a lot of that stuff.
Yeah, because you don't want to... Telemetry is private.
Yeah, so maybe it is. But we did get a couple questions about stylus, which also makes me assume it must be, if not new to F1, new to us seeing it. Rob, you want to take this next one?
Yeah. Colin writes, I just realized that Alpine has basically become Force India. It has the three most distinctive on-track Force India elements, Esteban Ocon, Otmar Szafnauer, and the BWT pink car. Yes, this is correct, and it's been throwing me off all season. Like it
I know,
is, I keep thinking that it's Aston because everything, like the Omar's there, the color scheme, like the fact that this is the package that seems to migrate around Szafnauer is really throwing me off. And hey, we've already got like some elbows out intra-team competition, so like the Force India vibes are really in, you know, it they're moving into the red or the pink, I guess, in this case. But I also feel like, is Aston Martin kind of a team without much of an identity right now?
Yeah.
There's not much.
I guess Aston Martin's the identity, but they don't have much of a recent history in F1, so it's kind of like an empty vessel a little bit.
They've got all the charisma of the Strolls.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, right? It's kind of, it feels like a weird corporate project in some ways, you know, that is backing a billionaire son, but also the car just doesn't, I mean, we'll see what happens as the season goes long and if there's more pace in it, but like it just doesn't, they have not been an interesting team, and now with like a lot of the Force India energy transferring, I'm really curious what Aston Martin is going to turn out to be. I
wonder if Vijay Mallya tunes in every now and again and is like, what?
I mean, that's what I was going to say. The on-track elements are there. The off-track ones are not.
Yeah. Yes, maybe for good. No offense to VJ, but, you know, he tried his best. He had a lot going on, I think.
Tax evasion.
Yeah. I got to take this one from Joshua. Hey, all. Being a fan since the start, I've wondered what is the difference about the new Grand Effect versus the older ones when it comes to safety? How are they avoiding the airplane crashes if negative pressure becomes positive? I haven't heard anyone talk about this. I haven't heard anyone talk about this either, and I'm quite interested. I don't have an answer to this, but I wanted to bring it to all of us here to chat about it. So what he's talking about is one of the issues with a lot of ground effect cars, and you saw this, and so there's the famous Mark Webber flipping his, is that a Le Mans car, I think, when these cars get a little bit of air underneath them, that when ground effect is lost, the cars have basically lost their ability to stick to the track, and if they go over a Singapore sling or like some sort of bump which gets air underneath the car in the wrong way, that the cars basically career into the sky. For me, I always thought that was a big issue with weight as well, that the types of cars that was happening to were on the lighter side, and these F1 cars are like actually fairly beefy in terms of their weight profile, and how tall they are, and where the center of gravity is like fairly low to the ground, even without the ground effect stuff. But I am interested in this because we unfortunately saw the first crashes in these cars, and they seem to do, I think, well. I mean, Mick is, he had to go to hospital, but he seemed to be okay the next day. But do you guys have any thoughts on this? Like, I know, Drew, you know ground effect because you fly airplanes, and I was wondering if you had maybe some more insight into this than I do.
Not really. I can really just guess, and I'm no aerodynamicist, but the way that the ground effect works is that in F1 cars, they create these ducts. I think that they're called Venturi channels.
Tunnels. Is it?
Tunnels. Yeah. And that shoots air under the car faster. And when air is going faster, it has a lower pressure. And when you've got low pressure under the car, it sucks it to the track, which is what you want, because you want that force, you want that grip, the tires benefit from. When you break that, I don't know if that means the opposite happens.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think it might just mean that you don't get the benefit of the Venturi tunnels. Then it's kind of left up to the rest of the aerodynamics on the car to continue the movement. And the aerodynamics are designed to keep the car down, all the rest of the wings and stuff. So I guess I don't know.
That's makes more sense in my head. Because you don't, like, ground effect in airplanes, right? I find this very interesting when you explained this to me years ago. This is the sort of, you should probably explain it, but it's the effect of, everyone feels it when they're landing in an airplane, that mm-hmm. the plane almost doesn't want to touch the ground when it's coming down right at the end, right?
Because right, there's like you're kind of on a cushion.
Yeah, cushion of air. It's not like that ever flips. It's not like at a certain stage ground effect just inverts and the plane gets like sucked to the ground or anything like that.
Right. It just, you just wait until the plane doesn't have enough speed to remain flying.
Right. So it's, you sort of like cushion it down, and then it, yeah, has its landing, hopefully, if you're landing it properly. So yeah, I mean, that seems to make sense, that the ground effect is less of a, that it's a more deliberate thing or something. If you're an aerodynamicist,
so
shiftf1podcast@gmail.com.
There you go.
I will also say, like, it looks like back when they were in their peak ground effect era, there was a massive amount of floor relative to the size of the car.
Right.
And so I do wonder if, like, the amount that the cars were relying on that floor generating, like, ground effect downforce is just really not comparable to, like, the sort of the more tapered layout of the modern cars. I could see that also being a major part of it, because it does seem like when ground effect was at its strongest, they were basically, like, you'd almost imagine a big rectangle with wheels
Yeah, which is like, what that Lamont car looks like. It looks like just a big slab.
Right.
And that can turn into, like, that. It doesn't matter what's going on under the channels underneath it. It's just a big wing at that point.
Right. And, like, that's just not the profile of the modern cars at all. And I suppose because they've also gone after the other thing is, like, in that era, the front and rear wings were also doing a whole lot relative to, like, the size of the car, that it could just be like the cars overall were so aerodynamically dependent that was kind of where the risk was coming from. But yeah, my guess might be it just might have been the way that, like, the ground effect era came into its own. And it was this anything goes approach to designing the silhouette of, like, the floor of the car. And now they're playing around with ground effect under much more constrained conditions. That would be that would be my guess. But yeah, like, I am sure if you're an aerodynamicist, reach out. But also, if you know which YouTube video explains this really well, like maybe Craig Scarborough or like, hey, just like link it to us. We'll find it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, just show us. We like, it's a great question.
And if you want to see the gnarly crash we're talking about, it's Mark Webber's Le Mans crash. I believe it was 99, not to be confused with the Valencia crash in F1 in 2010, which was also Mark Webber flying through the sky and doing corkscrews and thankfully walking away, but because he ran into the back of Buemi? I forget, someone like that.
I'll put links in the show notes.
Yeah, I did that one. Drew, do you mind taking this one from Morgan and Matt in Pittsburgh?
Yes, Morgan and Matt right. Do we think the overcut becomes more powerful this season? In years past, it was rare that a track had the right degradation, lap time, and pit lane length for it to be an option. But with the lower blanket temperatures and how difficult it seems to get these tires switched on, it seems like a fast outlap is no longer guaranteed, thereby weakening the undercut. Are we jumping to conclusions too early? Okay, so I think I messed this up in the primer with the definition of the overcut. So just to reset here, the undercut is when the chasing car pits first and then, despite losing time for the pit stop, goes back out and drives faster on fresh tires than the leading car's old tires, so that when the leading car finally does pit, they come out behind. To prevent this, the leading car will often pit directly after the chasing car to minimize the damage, which is a strategy you may hear called covering off. The overcut is when the chasing car waits for the leading car to pit first, then goes faster than the pitted car. Of course, that can only really be done if the chasing car is faster than the leading car. So you don't generally see the overcut as much because if the chasing car is faster, they just overtake on track. But on circuits where it's difficult to overtake, that's where the overcut becomes an option. And I would assume, again, not being a race strategist or really an expert of any kind, that the overcut is more likely with these new regulations because there isn't as much dirty air to degrade the tires.
Mm.
So the car behind has a much better chance of their tires retaining, you know, good condition. You know, Morgan and Matt also point out that the tire blanket temperatures are lower this year, you know, when they're sitting in the garage and they've got those blankets over them. And we've already seen some struggles with getting the new tires into that right temperature window for fast lap times.
Yeah.
So I think that makes sense too. You know, a car's ability to perform the overcut gets easier if you know that your rival is going to be slower coming out of the pits. So that'll then mean that you can go faster than them for much longer.
Also interject there, like the in sports car racing, they actually went so far as to ban tire blankets like at all. But it has been transformative in terms of like the dynamics of like what is happening when cars come out of the pits to that point of like the notion, because I think in previous season we're used to seeing it in F1 where like the tires are effectively back up to temperature within what, like 3 or 4 corners of leaving the pits. Like it's nothing. But in like sports car racing, especially when it's just maybe a little bit unusually cold, suddenly like the new set of tires is a real hurdle to overcome, which I think will be another interesting dynamic as F1 experiences different conditions throughout the long season.
Yeah, I mean, this race would also be interesting because it sounded like it was the ambient heat in the past two races was quite high, but because they were nighttime races, the track temps were not necessarily hot because they weren't getting direct sunlight then. So it'll be interesting to see how all of this works when we're on this newly laid foundation in a track in Melbourne during the day.
Yeah, I guess it remains to be seen how well the teams adjust to these new temps and stuff. So great thing to watch out for. So thank you, Morgan and Matt.
Yeah. Last question here from Jacob. This is my first season watching F1. What's the deal with the 1812 overture during the champagne spraying portion of the podium ceremony? It's a fine song, but the vibes seem a bit off. Is it just a weird tradition, or is there some reasoning behind it? So this is the champagne, which is actually preludes to Carmen. I had to look this up because I know that the 1812 overture is the one from V for Vendetta, you know, that one, yeah. Right? So it's actually a different song. They're both like sort of like, well, hey, but one of them is you know, I guess it's the overture, I guess, to Carmen, right? It's the song that plays before the prelude, before Carmen starts the opera. The reasoning behind it, apparently, I did some research on this because I actually was kind of like, yes, this is one of these things I have taken for granted in most motorsports, because it's not just an F1. They play this song sort of like for...
Do they really play it in other sports?
I've heard, yeah. I mean, maybe it's just like at like local go-kart things, or maybe it's...
Because it does seem... I agree with Jacob here. It does seem like a vestige of the Eccleston era. And I don't know if it was his idea, but maybe you'll tell me, but it just feels a little archaic and weird.
It's definitely archaic. the reasonings I have found, I did a bunch of digging on this, and there is no consensus, but the most widely accepted explanation is that this was a song that was used for a large period in French motorsports to signal the winner getting handed their trophy. And when the Grand Prix, I mean, it's called a Grand Prix, there is a lot of French tradition in motor racing by osmosis, as much as how involved French racing has been in F1 in particular, and just European motorsports over the past, you know, two centuries. But that was the reason why the preeminent song used for a ceremony was kind of this format, and they basically adopted it in some are of the early era of F1, which, you know, also vibes with the, you know, there's a lot of like cultural stuff that gets missed, but like, you know, there was a lot of celebrating France post-war. It had been liberated. It was part of the free world again.
Okay.
You know, F1 obviously had a big period pre and post-war. So it makes sense that this was kind of like used. But it's funny because, like, to me, it's, you know, that type of pomp and, you know, all of it, like the you know, the wreaths, and, you know, like, so much of F1 is this like sort of old European nonsense, but I can totally see how it might stand out as weirder, you know, kind of like me when I see them drinking the milk at Indianapolis. I'm like, what?
Yeah.
is that Indy, isn't it?
Yeah. Yep.
But yeah, apparently that's the reason. It's just, it's one of those traditions, man. It doesn't have to make sense, I guess.
Well, thank you. I am enlightened here. Feel better for knowing that. But that's emails. shiftf1podcast@gmail.com. You can also hit us up on Twitter @shiftf1podcast. I am @DrewScanlon. That is @DannyO'Dwyer and @RobZachney. That's us around the internet. Should we take it around the world, Danny?
It's around the world. Yeah.
Well, Danny, the Camping World Trucks are back. And guess who else is back? The Blue DTM? Emu.
The Blue, excuse me?
Yes, the Blue Emu Maximum Pain Relief 200.
Oh, man.
Is what the trucks will be racing this weekend. We've also got the NASCAR Xfinity Series. Oh, by the way, everyone's in Martinsville in NASCAR land this year, or this weekend. Martin has a ville in Virginia. The Xfinity Series race is called Call 811 Before You Dig 250, powered by call811.com.
They don't want you hitting those power lines or gas lines, man. They just call before you dig.
Seriously, my favorite dim sum place in San Francisco got destroyed by a gas line explosion.
No way.
Yep. Hong Kong Lounge 2, RIP.
Is there a Hong Kong Lounge 3?
Not yet.
Wow.
Yeah.
So call 811. Don't be digging.
Yes. Yes. I absolutely, my favorite race names, I think, is when it's, you know, brand something, something, something brought to you by same brand. Love it. Love it. The Repco Supercars are at the Albert Park Grand Prix Circuit, as previously mentioned, for not one, but four races this weekend. The World Superbike Championship is at Motorland Aragon.
Aragon. Oh, yeah, in Middle Earth.
Yes, right. Formula E is back for the Rome E-Prix.
Woo! They're just going to roam around. There's no circus. You just have to just explore. It's very a la carte.
Explore Italy. Look at all the statues. The IMSA WeatherTech Sports Car Championship is at Long Beach for the Acura Grand Prix of Long Beach.
You also have to drive Acuras. It sucks.
Formula is at the Fuji Speedway. That's at the foothills of Mount Fuji in the town of Oyama, Suunto District, Shizuoka Prefecture.
Oh, great prefecture.
It really is. MotoGP, boy, we are really back in the spirit of racing here, is at the Circuit of the Americas this weekend.
Damn. Are they? Damn. My wife is there right now. Well, she'll be back. I was like, maybe I should have gone. Maybe I should have gone to Austin this week with her to visit friends. I could have snuck off and seen Fabio Quartararo.
The Motocross Grand Prix is at Cosodromo Ciclamino in Italy. It's a pretty cool name.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
And lastly, we got NASCAR.
My lord.
Also at Martinsville, also Blue Emu. Maximum pain relief 400.
Do you remember the Blue Emu?
I don't.
This is pain relief tablets made from emus.
Oh, now I remember it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they put it right there. Usually they try and, like, you know, obfuscate the source of things sometimes, you know, because it freaks people out. Because people think Red Bull's got, like, bull sperm in it, and, you know, you just try and not. But, yeah. Does it say made with real emu?
I think the website does. But Formula One is also this weekend. The Australian Grand Prix kicks off. Follow closely now, because Australia's in the future. Our weekend starts Thursday, April 7th at 11 p.m. Eastern time.
Awesome. Give it to me.
That's practice one. And then practice two is 2 a.m. Friday morning. That's on ESPN News and ESPN2, respectively. Then Friday, April 8th, practice three is 11 p.m. Eastern time on ESPN News. And then qualifying 2 a.m. Saturday morning on ESPN2. And the race, everyone, technically Sunday at 1 a.m. Eastern time, 10 p.m. Pacific on ESPN.
Beautiful. So there you go. 10 p.m. races.
Yeah.
On the West Coast, we had them all along.
That's Saturday. Saturday, 10 p.m.
10 p.m.
Pacific time.
Beautiful. And if you get bored on Sunday, watch that new MotoGP series. They just did their own Drive to Survive.
That's right.
MotoGP Unlimited?
Unlimited.
Unlimited. Although there is a limit. There's a specific amount of episodes. So, I don't know about that. It's got Rossi's last year, I guess, if it's about last year. So.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe we should do that for Patreon or something.
Maybe we should. Danny, final thoughts. Heading into Australia.
Massive thoughts with all of our friends in Australia who have waited and waited and waited for the return of the Grand Prix. I hope you're able to attend. You have a blast. Stay safe. Enjoy the racing. We are delighted to be back in your fair country.
Yes. Final thoughts, Rob.
Don't sleep on IndyCar. Just putting that out there. The race they had a couple weeks ago at Texas Motor Speedway, like one of the wildest finishes I've seen in a race in the last year. We're talking about like less than a car width difference as they cross the car length's difference as they cross the finish line with a last lap lead change.
How's our boy Roman doing?
It's a sophomore slump, a little bit. They're having car sales issues. It's not going well. No. The real breakout star is like Scott McLaughlin, who's a New Zealand driver, is just like wrecking house.
Dude, that's awesome. I loved watching him in supercars.
Yeah, he's awesome. He is tearing it up. In IndyCar, to the point where the last race he looked incredible on the oval. He was dominant at St. Pete. It might be, if he keeps up like this the championship might be wrapped up fast if he maintains this form, but it will be a hell of a thing to see because it is immaculate driving.
Damn.
Cool. IndyCar also puts up a lot of their stuff on YouTube. I don't think maybe full races this year, but they certainly do.
Because it's all on Peacock.
Oh, of course.
But the full races on Peacock are very good.
They also did a 40-minute highlight where they just take out all the yellow flags, which is pretty cool.
And there are a lot of yellow flags.
How many races into the season are we?
Just two.
Okay. Oh, yeah. All right. Ooh. This is it, though, isn't it?
Here, the 2022 Fast Forward Texas Motor Speedway in 30 minutes.
Oh, that's good. That's good. That's a good length.
I'll put that in the show notes.
Not too long, not too short. Just right. Goldilocks.
All right. Well, that is it for us. If you'd like to support the show and get access to all of our bonus episodes and the official Shift F1 Discord, you can do so over at patreon.com/ShiftF1. Have a good race weekend, everyone. We will see you all next week.